On May 9, 2025, Peter M. Sandman gave a Grand Rounds presentation via Zoom on Earned Mistrust, How Public Health Forfeited Trust During COVID and Got Away With It Long Before COVID. His sponsor was the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering of the Bloomberg School of Public Health, Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Sandman made his case that public health agencies and experts often tell noble lies, misleading the public for its own good. He had long predicted that this would eventually backfire, and during the COVID pandemic, he argued, it finally did. This is the 55-minute Q&A that followed the presentation. A little to his surprise, there wasn't much pushback. The focus was more on what public health professionals could do to earn trust back.
And we'll send out a second Q&A. Thank you, Salvador.
Okay, we're on the record. Okay, and the floor is open.
All right, do we have any questions from our crew? We actually still have quite a bit of number. Okay, we've got Paul ready. Paul, go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. Just want you to know that I give a risk communication lecture to the public health students, and I use some of your material, so much appreciated. I appreciated your talk, but I wanted to actually maybe ask you to be directed in a little bit different way. As a public health person, one of the real challenges I have is to explain to folks how our public health science works by stressing both the positive things, but also trying to deal with the uncertainties. So it's not a matter of lying, it's a matter of trying to convey a message that is honest, but still leaves room for the fact that we don't know everything. I wanted to get your reaction on how we do that, because really to me, that's the essence of a lot of what our public health communication has to be. And I work in environmental health. I'm in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering, and I really work a lot on alternatives to animals and biomedical testing. So thank you again, and I look forward to your answer to the question.
I think you're very right about, you know, that sounding overconfident or actually feeling overconfident is a smaller sin than lying about facts. I can say you're lying about how certain you are, but that doesn't quite capture how it feels to you when you turn, you know, optimism into overconfidence. So I think that's a distinction worth hanging on to. The problem with uncertainty is nobody likes it. The public health people would rather sound like they're sure. The media would rather you sounded sure. You get better play if you say simple things than if you say complicated, nuanced, uncertain things. The audience would rather you were sure. Now there's research to indicate that, you know, if you candidly and confidently admit uncertainty, you know, where, you know, you're not sounding like, you know, you can't bear how uncertain you are. You sound like, well, that, you know, that's the business we're in, you know, where, you know, I mean, it's a novel pathogen, you know, we're, you know, as David Heyman, who I criticized, you know, for his polio response, said, you know, in another outbreak entirely, the magnificent statement, he said, we are building our boat and sailing it at the same time. Which is a lovely way of saying, oh, we're uncertain and we're not going to let that uncertainty get in the way of making policies. And that means the implication is, and you could say this explicitly too, we're going to get some stuff wrong. And when we get it wrong, we promise to notice. You know, we'll be careful about confirmation bias. We will work hard to notice when we're getting it wrong. We will listen to the people who were telling us that we were wrong in the first place, and we will collect the data to indicate that we're wrong. And as soon as we begin to feel like, you know, our uncertainty, you know, we made an uncertain conclusion, and it was, you know, it, as we are getting better data, we're not only getting more certain, we're getting more certain in a different direction. It's not turning out to be more Y and less X, we promise to tell you. Okay. And if you say that all in advance, people don't like it. but they can get it. They can hear it, and the, although they are displeased, they trust you more after an acknowledgement of uncertainty than they do if you sound confident, and particularly if you sound confident and get things wrong. It's much easier to change your mind if you warned people that you were uncertain and would change your mind. One more thing I want to say about uncertainty. It's not sufficient to acknowledge uncertainty. You kind of have to proclaim it. If it's a bullet point down at the bottom of your PowerPoint, or it's something you put in parentheses or something you say sotto voce without putting a lot of emphasis on it, the media won't get it. The audience won't get it. It will disappear, and then you turn out wrong, and people say you told us it was X, and it turned out to be Y, and you say, no, look very carefully at that asterisk. That's where I said I might be wrong, and the asterisk doesn't do it. You have to aggressively proclaim uncertainty, and if you do that, the media will carry the story, and the audience will tolerate it. But it's not enough to acknowledge uncertainty.
All right, so before we go to Terry, I want to go to the thing in the chat that we've gotten a lot of like thumbs
Please
up
don't
and
punch out
whatever. People
X.
want to know how to earn back the public's trust. And I can show their slides if you want, but happy to bring those up or we can just chat it out.
Why don't you bring up the there are two slides on how to earn back trust. If you can bring them up, I think that would be good. And I can, just sort of very quickly, the most important one of all these bullet points, but the first bullet point is acknowledge what you did to earn distrust, not just once, not just quietly, but you have to wallow in loud, endless mea culpas, until your critics say it's time to move on. You wait until your critics say, all right, we get it, you're sorry, you don't have to keep saying so, then you can move on. Now, the second bullet point, I think, is by far the most important. Take the blame for what you did, and focus on what you did that's blameworthy. There's lots of stuff other people did that's blameworthy. And maybe you're responsible for 90% of the distrust in your agency. Your public health is responsible for 90% of the distrust in public health. Maybe you're only responsible for 10%. I don't know. But whatever percentage you're responsible for, that's in your hands. That's the one you can address. That's the one you can change. That's the one you can mitigate. So don't focus on what your opponents did wrong. Don't focus on what politicians did wrong. Don't focus on what anti-vaxxers did wrong. Focus on what you did wrong. Third bullet point, listen. You don't know everything you did wrong. Ask. That's partly because you want to hear. It's partly because your critics want to vent. An apology before you know this in your personal life. If you're angry at somebody, you want to tell them how mad you are before they tell you how sorry they are. You don't want them to preempt your venting with their apology. So you have to let your critics vent. You don't rebut their grievances. You do periodically echo their grievances. Say you're sorry.
Thing
Don't
that's
ask for
super.
tr don't ask for immediate trust.
Oh.
I'm sorry. I'm getting conversation.
I muted that
Don't a
person.
okay. Don't ask for immediate trust. Acknowledge that trust will take a while to rebuild. Focus on trustworthiness rather than trust. Go to the next slide. Accountability mechanisms are super important, so we don't have to trust you so much. Come up with ways that we can track what you're doing, so we don't have to trust what you're doing. Bring your critics on board. CDC did a spectacular job long before COVID and going into COVID of recruiting people of color. It has never done, as far as I know, the same kind of recruitment of conservatives. So it's focused It seems to me way more on ethnic diversity than on opinion diversity. And you need opinion diversity in public health. There was a real need for conservatives in public health agencies, but it's never too late to bring them on board. Diagnose aspects of your culture that led to these mistakes. Promise to do better, or better yet, promise to try to do better. And this very important point at the better at the end here, you can't just do better. That's what my clients always used to say. I mean, can't we just stop lying? And I would say, no. They won't notice you stopped lying unless you admit you were lying. You have to wallow in what you misbehave in your misbehavior before you get any credit for abandoning that misbehavior. And that's the recommendation my clients had the hardest time accepting. They were usually willing to improve. What they weren't willing to do is tell everybody what the baseline was from which they were trying to improve. You get a lot further, a lot quicker if you acknowledge what you've been doing wrong. Now, all of that, I got to say, all of that is grounded in, you're still running the agency. And for a lot of state agencies, that's still true. For a lot of local agencies, that's still true. The extent to which it's still true for national agencies, I mean, if you're working for JFK Jr., I don't want to go there. That's a whole other hour at least. But it may be that the task right now isn't to how to earn back trust. It's how to promise that if we give you another chance, you'll do better. It may be a matter of still of acknowledging what you did that caused you to lose power. Start telling the whole truth. Adopt a standard of radical candor. Look for a middle. Find ways to work with your critics. Find ways to do what are called adversarial collaborations with your critics, where you work together. And maybe you work together on research and find out who's right or whether the truth is in the middle. Maybe you work together on mitigation efforts. But we're not going to get anywhere in a battle between the public health mainstream and the people who hate the mainstream. It doesn't matter whether the mainstream is in charge or the people who hate the mainstream is in charge. As long as they're at loggerheads with each other, you're not going to get anywhere. So the task is to find that middle, and you need a plan to earn back trust, not just a plan to win back power. So that's very quick, but maybe some of that helps.
Sorry, I could not find myself. Go
I
ahead.
should let me let me say one more thing. One of the things I learned from 40 years of consulting is it's usually not too late. I worked with companies that were way more distrusted than public health. I won't name them, but you can probably guess what some of them were. I worked with some of the most mistrusted and justifiably mistrusted companies in the world who would call me only an extremist because everybody hated them. And it was often possible for them to win back trust. It's not too late. But you can't win back trust just by reforming. You have to win back trust by acknowledging how you lost trust and by wallowing in contrition. Okay, now I'll stop and we'll move on to the
All
next
right,
comment.
well, next up is Chris.
Hey, Peter, thanks so much. I guess I'm just wondering, you've painted a really good picture of you kind of in a I don't know, like a war room style to help manage, right, this loss of trust. And when you try to make that case of your roadmap, what are some of those examples? And I'm thinking particularly of the public health agencies, where for all the reasons you mentioned, they have to be seen as authority. It's in the middle of a crisis. They need to try to do something to protect people. So what are some examples you try to share to say, well, don't think of it as waffling. Think of it as transparency, that uncertainty. What are those examples where it worked, where you can say, trust in this? And sorry for the ironic turn of phrase there.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, and I don't have a wonderful answer. I mean, there are, it seems to me, examples of agencies acknowledging the kinds of things that agencies don't like to acknowledge, and not suffering as much or not having public health suffer in the ways that they imagined it would. So that, for example, it's pretty clear to me that if the mitigation strategies you have are not terribly good, that overstating how good they are is not necessary, that it works, if not just as well, almost as well, and more sustainably, to say, look, this only helps a little, but it's all we've got, and we're looking for things that'll help better, but this does help a little. And I mean, if you say about masks, it only helps a little, especially cloth masks. You're not undermining the use. You don't have to overstate the value of a mitigation in order to persuade people that it's better than nothing. What I don't have, and what I suspect you are actually asking for, is examples of public health agencies wallowing in contrition and recouping trust. And I don't have those examples. I wish I did. I don't have examples of public health agencies wallowing in contrition and not recouping trust, because I don't have examples of public health agencies wallowing in contrition. I do have examples from the profit-making sector of companies that have won back trust as a result of being candid about what they did wrong and being apologetic and setting up accountability mechanisms so that they didn't need to be as trusted in future. And many of those, some of those examples at least, are on my website. I have no examples to give you from public health, but there are still 92 people in on this conversation. You can be the examples. There you are. Well, you're all in public health, I think, and you have an opportunity to go out there and try the strategies we just talked about for recouping trust and see what happens. I'm prepared to bet that you will come up with an improvement in trust by owning your prior misdeeds. And then, that I'm convinced that's true. I have examples from the corporate world, but I do not have any public health examples because I don't think public health does it. But I'm looking for public health to do it.
Right, we've got Annie next.
Actually, this is the perfect timing. So my name is Annie, and the reason why I say that this is the perfect timing is that my question is related to what you've just said, Peter. So to give, well, before I go into my question, I'd like to give it more context so that my question makes more sense. So the context is that Dr. Fauci actually he had a small team of camera people following around him for about a year or so. When that documentary came out, the documentary's name is Fauci, literally called Fauci. That's the documentary's name. He did an interview with the Rolling Stone. I posted the link to the Rolling Stone article somewhere in the chat. So in that interview and in the documentary, he later on apologized for his messaging on regards to masking in the pandemic. And he said, to summarize what he said that there was no data back then in regards to masking, and he didn't know that there was this. He didn't know that the aerosol transmission had occurred. So my question is that if there is no data, wouldn't it be better to just for scientists just say, listen, we don't have data, so we're gonna get back to you as more data comes along, rather than go with the assumption that, oh, well, initially we thought, oh, we initially went with masking is not relevant because or not important because there was just simply no data.
I mean, I just don't think you can, I mean, there's a pathogen. People are getting sick and they're asking you what to do. And it's not like you have no knowledge. You have knowledge of prior pandemics. You have knowledge of the biology of viruses. You don't know how COVID is going to behave, but you have some basis for making educated guesses. And I think you can't. It's basically irresponsible to say we're not sure and we don't want to tell you anything until we're sure. So, after the pandemic is over, we will tell you what you should have done. You just can't do that. So you have to take your best shot. But you should take your best shot acknowledging that it's an uncertain shot
It's an
grounded
uncertain shot. Okay, so he
it's an
should have made that
educated guess.
clear.
Yeah, you have to make that clear, or you wind up being thought to be dishonest. But I don't think you can not say anything. I mean, I
Right.
worked a lot with corporations where the factory blew up, or the pipeline exploded, or whatever. Something horrible happened, and it's going to take months to do a fault analysis and figure out what went wrong. It's usually three or four different things that went wrong. But you can't refuse to talk until you know. You have to talk before you know. But your core message is we don't know yet, but here's what we think. Here's why we think it. And uncertainty is not dichotomous. This is not a matter of either you're uncertain or you're ignorant. You want to replicate in your audience the level of uncertainty that you're feeling. And sometimes it's we don't have great data yet, but we have pretty good data and we're pretty sure this is true. We'd be surprised if it turns out wrong. Sometimes it's we don't have any data, but we have a lot of precedent from prior events. And we wouldn't be shocked if it turns out wrong, but we think we're probably right. And sometimes it's the toss of a coin, but it's not usually the toss of a coin. You usually have enough information to make a non-random recommendation, and it's your public health obligation to do that. But acknowledging or as I tried to say, proclaiming how uncertain you are.
Okay, understood. Thank
All right.
you.
Thank you, Annie. On to Mark.
Hi. I wanted to ask about, you made a comment about public statements that the COVID vaccine was sterilizing. And I'm shocked that anybody would say that, frankly, because there's no vaccine that is sterilizing. And so for someone to come up, I agree with what you're saying. But I would say that that would suggest that whoever said that had, made a mistake or overstated something. It's not something that the entire public health messaging had made. And so some of the comments that you picked from this agency over here and that agency over here, and while it makes sense to for a unified voice, I mean, is that it was, it was insane how many the questions that were coming in, trying to keep track of every piece of data that was coming in terms of what it meant, and then making public health recommendations based on that. Some public health agencies are probably doing better. At the same time, society that did to sound bites, like short text messages, tweets, how it seems like it's a very difficult situation to convey the certainty of a particular recommendation in its detail when you have like basically a couple of seconds.
Yeah,
Can
you're
we talk?
right. I mean, in fairness, you have all the time in the world in the middle of a pandemic. You are the most important story going. I mean, most of the time in risk communication, the problem is that you won't have only a couple of seconds, because people's attention span is extremely limited for a risk that they're not that interested in. So if you're warning people to wear seatbelts, you're going to have a very hard time getting more than 10 or 15 seconds of attention. If you're talking to people about what to do about the fact that this is the worst pandemic in a century, you've got all the time in the world. And you can absolutely afford to go in detail. You still need to have simple messages as well as complicated messages. You don't, you know, you, you know, because some people are going to want to tune out and then they just want your bottom line. But you know, that aside, you're right, it's difficult. And you know, I'm not trying to claim that this is easy, and it, you know, it's way easier to give advice in the abstract than it is to implement that advice in the concrete and in a real situation. And you could, you know, you're not the only source, and you know, there are questions of, you know, how do you coordinate and to what extent should you coordinate, and is it harmful or helpful if different people in public health are saying different things? And I'm kind of a supporter of letting that those differences of opinion show. That's a good way to demonstrate uncertainty, if the disagreements are respectful. The problem that happens, say, between mainstream public health and the Great Barrington Declaration wasn't that there was a disagreement, it was that it was a disrespectful disagreement, and the mainstream made an effort to shut down, not a successful effort, but an effort to shut down the alternative point of view. But you know, part of letting uncertainty show is letting expert disagreement shows. But for sure, it's not easy. And I'm not claiming it's easy. I am claiming that public health can do a way better job than it did this time.
All right, Steve.
Hi, Peter. It's Steve.
Hi.
If you remember that I was at one time a quantitative risk assessor. And one of the things that I worry about all the time is knowing that a lot of people just don't like dealing with numbers, with quantity rather than quality, with grade rather than certainty. How can we do a better job of saying things like not asking the question, masks, do masks work? But asking, you know, how well do masks work? Which masks work better than others? Do the masks work well enough to justify the proposed interventions, and realizing that all these questions have subjective components on how much people value one thing versus the other.
A number of answers. I mean, there is a fair amount of research, Steve, some of which I think you probably know, on how to explain quantitation to people who don't like thinking in terms of quantitation, and you know, ways that work well and ways that work less well. What kind of graphics get across the message well? What kind of graphics tend to backfire? I am a big believer that you know, you can use comparative adjectives, you know, instead of numbers, with audiences that are having difficulty understanding the numbers, and obviously you can include both. But I mean, your goal, as I said in an earlier response, your goal is to replicate in the audience your understanding of the situation. If your understanding is not dichotomous, and if you're a quantitative person, your understanding is not going to be dichotomous, then you want to replicate that. And even if the question is dichotomous, you know, should I or shouldn't I wear a mask? You know, then you want to replicate the not so dichotomous understanding of that question. Depends what kind of mask, depends where, depends for how long, you know, depends, you know, whether you feel well and you're trying to protect yourself, or you feel crappy and you're trying to protect the people you're with. You know, so I mean, I think explaining that things are not as simple as they seem is hard, but we know a good deal about how to do it. And you know, I am not convinced that the main problem is that it's difficult. I am convinced that the main problem is that we don't usually try. It is difficult, and when we try, we won't always succeed, or that's not dichotomous either. We won't succeed as much as we hoped we would. Anybody who's ever been a teacher knows you don't succeed as much as you hope you will. But the main problem is having perhaps despaired of explaining a nuance. We don't try, and we say, oversimplified, I'm inclined to use a word that George Bush once used, we miss oversimplify. We oversimplify in ways that are misleading. And when we're caught at it, then we say, well, people don't understand complexity and it's too hard to explain complexity. It is hard to explain complexity, but we do a better job of that when we try. And then the last thing you said, which I definitely want to underline and echo, is no matter how much you explain about the evidence, you have an obligation to notice and to share with your audience that you have noticed that the questions they're considering are not only about the evidence. There's quantitative data, and then there's qualitative opinion about the data, and then there's values. And how safe is safe enough is not a scientific question, as you know. Anybody who's in risk assessment, in quantitative risk assessment, knows once you've measured the risk and you've measured, your level of uncertainty, so you have a standard error around your point estimate of the risk. That doesn't, different people can look at those data and they both agree that, yeah, thank you, these are the data. And then some of them say, therefore, we should take precautions. And someone else says, therefore, we should say screw it and ignore it and not worry about it and go about our lives because those are grounded in values. And one of the big problems, and Francis Collins, to his credit, Fauci's former boss, former head of NIH, has been very honest since leaving NIH, since retiring, about saying that NIH neglected values. That it you know and he's acknowledged that this is a problem public health routinely has, that if you go into public health, you're inclined to think that health is all that matters, or at least it's the main thing that matters. So you're not too worried about freedom. You're not too worried about the economy. You're not too worried about religion. You're not too worried about education. You're worried about illness and death. And so you decide to recommend lockdowns, and you're not doing, you are trying as best you can to assess the extent to which lockdowns will save lives and prevent morbidity. But you're not even, Collins has conceded, you're not even thinking about the rest of it. How will the lockdowns affect the economy? How will they affect people's psyches? How will they affect education? How will they affect people's sense of whether they're being coerced or they're free in their lives? And those are things, and this is part of why mistrust has been, sort of right-wing coded. Those are things that the right tends to be more focused on than the left. And as a result, the right was likelier than the left to say, how dare you think health is all that matters? But Collins has been very candid in saying, it's not just that we didn't do a good job of explaining the data. We didn't do a good job of noticing that the data are not the only thing that matters in deciding what the policies ought to be. And hopefully, public, that's not an honesty issue. That's a different set of issues entirely. But hopefully, public health will do better on that in future.
Thank
I
you.
really like that point. Ram, you're next. And then I'm going to go to Eric's question in the chat because he can't raise his hand.
Thank you. So great talk and great criticisms of public health. One question, so you drew an analogy between how you made a case to your corporate clients versus the public health clients. And in the case of the corporate clients, the motivating factor was, okay, your profit margins are going down because of this lack of trust in your company. Versus in public health, I think what you were saying was, well, your trust is going down, but wouldn't, and you also mentioned the point that public health scientists, leaders, whatever, when they make something, say a statement that is not completely true or even lying, they're motivated by saving lives. So wouldn't a better framing of the problem be, you might save a few lives now by this lie, but you are actually going to lose a lot more lives in the long term because people will not trust you. So the payoff is not your improved professional standing. I mean, it's important, but in fact, more lives will be saved overall. So if you're doing cost-benefit analysis, it's like, you know, the same currency is being used. You're losing more lives. Saving more lives now will cost you more lives. Saving some lives now will cost you more lives later.
Yeah, I totally agree, Ram. I should have made that clearer. The dependent variable that matters in public health is the public's health. And you know, I mean, you framed it very well. In the short term, lying can save lives. In the long term, if you get caught or even not get caught, if people smell a rat, if people sense that you're not leveling with them, and the trust declines and the willingness to take your recommended precautions declines, then public health declines. People die, people get sick. Because they don't trust you, because they're listening to ivermectin salesmen instead of listening to you, and that's on you. That happened because you earned their mistrust.
All right. So Eric's question in the chat: how would you address the concern that in this polarized political environment, publicly apologizing will be weaponized?
Yeah, it will. I mean, everything is weaponized. If you know, if stonewalling is also weaponized, you know, and then the question is, which is a stronger weapon? You know, they're stonewalling. They refuse to admit that they did this. They've learned nothing. Or, you know, even the public health experts admit that they screwed up X and Y. And if you admit you screwed up X and Y, they will weaponize it against you. My point is, it's a weaker weapon against you than your stonewalling and refusing to acknowledge what you did wrong. If I'm your opponent, I'll use what I can against you. I can tell you, anti-vaxxers very much hope that public health continues. Let's assume you're 95% right and you're lying about 5% of some vaccine controversy. They hope you will continue to lie about that 5%. So they can feature that 5%, what CDC isn't telling you about this vaccine, what FDA isn't telling you about this vaccine. That's their stock in trade. You know, and if you start admitting the 5%, they will say even CDC, even FDA admits this, but they're not going to be happy. That's a much weaker attack.
All right, thank you. We've got Jerry, and then I'm going to go to the chat for the next question. So, Jerry, go ahead.
Yeah, so slight variation on the will the apology be weaponized. My question is, will it be effective in this environment? If CDC comes out and expresses contrition, isn't that going to come across like Biden administration bashing? And will it really be seen as contrition? And will it be effective?
That's a very good question. It's, I mean, at the moment, you know, if you accept my metaphor of hostile takeover, and I mean, it's an unfair metaphor. I don't think Bhattacharya and McCary and others are entirely hostile to public health, but they are reasonably interpreted as hostile to the mainstream approach, the approaches that the mainstream took to COVID. So for them to say our agency was wrong is going to be felt more like an attack than an acknowledgement. It has to come from the people who did it. And that, you know, that's why, you know, I mean, my it's sort of in my first slide, I said, you know, my usual frame is you're in charge, you've been dishonest, you're losing trust, it's time to come clean. And it's a tougher issue when the lost trust has led to loss of control of the agency. And, you know, it doesn't do any good for them to come clean about your sins. It still has to be you coming clean about your sins. And if you don't have a microphone anymore, I agree, that's problematic. But that's why it is so valuable to have Collins saying we screwed this up and we screwed this up and we screwed this up. And I would love to see a joint op-ed between Collins and Bhattacharya Talking about what they've both learned, because Collins got mainstream got a lot of stuff wrong. It's not like the Great Barrington Declaration didn't get anything wrong. It's not like Bhattacharya didn't get anything wrong. So a joint op-ed about we were both taking our best shot. We should have been talking to each other and listening to each other and learning from each other, and we will jointly do better next time. I would be delighted to see that joint op-ed. So if they're listening, go for it.
Great. Thanks for that question, Jerry. So David Johns asked in the chat, what do you think of the public health battle against misinformation? Is it possible for public health actors to effectively fight against lies and quackery when we're in a position of needing to win back trust?
No. I mean, that's the bottom line. Until you have acknowledged your own untrustworthiness, your attack on somebody else's untrustworthiness backfires. You're talking only to the choir. Now, there's some value in talking to the choir, right? I mean, the people who trust you and distrust the outliers, it is useful for you to remind them that the outliers are wrong about, X and Y and Z. It's not totally useless for you to remind everybody that there's lots of evidence that vaccines don't cause autism. But it's not going to convince the people who are listening to the outliers that they should listen to you instead. You can't combat misinformation from a position of distrust. What we need is people who are not you, who haven't forfeited trust, who are more in the middle, to stick with Bhattacharya, the new head of NIH, if he says something positive about the MMR, that carries some weight. If he starts rebutting misinformation that comes from what is loosely thought of as his side, that can be useful. There's very little that mainstream public health can do to correct misinformation coming from the outliers. The outliers have to police themselves. You guys have to police yourselves.
That's great. And I wanted to follow up on, you were talking about the different values, public health values, morbidity and mortality. We want to save the most lives. It's in our slogan, even millions of lives saved one at a time. And how can public health hear more about what other values it should be considering, when it comes to be that moment where a decision has to be made? You don't know what you don't know. So how can public health bring those perspectives in?
Well, taking your question exactly as it's framed, I don't think it's that hard to do once public health decides to do it. I mean, it's a matter of, broadening the number of people or the range of people you listen to, broadening the range of people that you bring into your agency. There's no reason why a health agency can't have an advisory committee that is populated with people who aren't health people. And you're not relying on them for health expertise. They're your, the rest of everything that's important advisory group. So you can do it. But I actually think the better solution is for public health to stop thinking it ought to be making these decisions. I'm fine with public health being focused on only mortality and morbidity, as long as it's not in charge, as long as it's giving advice grounded in that preoccupation to political leaders who are also listening to people who are worried about the economy and people who are worried about education and people who are worried about freedom and people who are worried about all the other values that we care about. The essence of democratic decision making, as I understand it, is, experts should stay in their own lane. And I'm not that committed to CDC acquiring a lot of economic expertise. I'm much more committed to CDC not being the one who decides we ought to have a shutdown. CDC can advise on our best guesses or our best, modeling estimate, which is another word for guess, is that if we do it this way, here's what the hospital situation will be. Here's what we would expect in the way of mortality and morbidity. If we do that, here's what we expect. That, you know, that's your job, is to advise decision makers on the health implications of alternative policies. It is not your job to pick the policy. Now, that's not your fault. If the decision maker says, I'm going to do whatever you recommend, you'd have to be some kind of saint to say, oh, God, don't do that. You know, you got to listen to these other people, too. It's not your fault that you were listened to too much in during COVID, but it is a problem.
That's a really great perspective, and I appreciate you saying that. Ishwarya, go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Sandman. It was so good to hear from you. I work with Tara on a lot of our work around countering misleading rumors, misinformation, information manipulation. This is so fascinating. Clearly, you've gotten a lot of things right. You predicted a lot, and it's come to happen. What are your predictions for the future around risk comms? And the other fun question I'll ask you is, what is the weirdest public health rumor you encountered in the past 10 years or ever?
I think the weirdest rumor is probably, there are chips in the vaccine. It surprised me that that one had legs. That sounded crazy enough that I thought, no, but even the people who know, who totally have lost trust in public health, they're not going to believe that there are chips in the vaccine. And, that actually has significant followership. So, that's the answer to this second half of your question. My prediction, I'm very tempted to refuse to answer because it's such a depressing conviction. My sense is my corporate consultants over 40 plus years of consulting got it about 15% of the time. A good day was when I could go home and say to Jody, they bought about 15% of what I had to tell them. Every once in a while, I would have a client that would say, we're going to do whatever you tell us, our lawyer reports to you, our PR guy reports to you, or everybody reports to you. We're going to do whatever you say. That was very rare. And when it happened, it was terrifying. But usually they were not taking most of my advice, but they were taking some of it as long as I was at least in the room or in memory. But recidivism was horrible. I mean, there were companies that, that used me as a verb. There were companies that sandmanized all their new middle managers and hire. If you came into this company, you had to go through 3 days of sandman before you started actually making decisions. I thought I was integrated into the culture, integrated enough to become a verb. And 20 years later, there's nothing left. I can't distinguish those companies from the companies I never worked with. So even in the corporate world, this stuff was very hard to sell and very hard for people to keep doing it. But in the corporate world, I had 15% success. I had way less than that in the public health world. So I am skeptical. I am pessimistic. I haven't stopped trying. I mean, here I am coming out of retirement to talk to the next generation of public health leadership, and hopefully a handful of you will hang on to some of what I have to say and use it and teach it to your colleagues. And I haven't given up, but I can't claim to be optimistic. So you ask what my prediction is. My prediction is you'll keep screwing up. Sorry.
Yeah. It's a tough situation. I would say, to add on to your vaccine rumor, we actually ran into folks who their town was changing the street lamps from that, the orangey color to the big bright white lights. And they thought that there's a rumor that the lights were now being changed so that they could use the new wavelength with the microchips to track where people were going in the town. So it was an extension of the microchip, which I just thought was, it was just such a, interesting rumor based on, you know, what was happening on the ground in their town. So,
Yeah, it's pretty
yeah,
wild.
we'll go to Julia.
Hi, Peter. Wonderful talk. Thank you so much. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the role of empathy, you know, maybe missing empathy in this discourse, because I mean, I've been saying honestly very similar things to what you were saying for a long time, and I've always run into this like we can't talk to an anti-vaxxer. They are Trump supporters. They're all stupid. You know, so basically the internal arrogance and paternalism of this profession that's honestly not news, right? But it's really difficult, makes it much harder to overcome this bridge and to talk to the other side, maybe, you know, earn trust back. Because what you had said, what we have to do to earn trust is to admit our shortcomings. It's very hard emotionally to do this if you detest the other side, right? So how can we solve this issue particularly?
Yeah, Julia, you're obviously totally right. Empathy is kind of a precondition for being heard by people who don't start out agreeing with you. I don't need empathy to
Right.
learn from somebody who's telling me something I already believe, but to learn from somebody who's telling me I'm wrong, I need to feel some commonality with that person. Maybe I need to feel that they like me. Maybe I need to feel that they share some of my values. Now, I used to think that can't be faked. If you detest somebody, it's gonna show, and you basically are disqualified from being able to talk mean usefully to that person. And I no longer believe that. I actually think if the Alcoholics Anonymous slogan, "Fake it till you make it," is not crazy. And I think empathy is as much a skill as it is a frame of mind. And I think you can, you and I actually have written one of the most complicated, difficult, unapproachable, this is a strong recommendation, right? One of the hardest things on my website is an article I wrote on empathy and risk communication, trying to talk about exactly what you're talking about, but trying to talk about it as a skill. How do you deal empathically with people you don't want to deal empathically with? And I don't despair of that being doable. But again, I think the dominant problem is not that it can't be done. Granted, it's hard, but I think it can be done. We don't want to do it. People don't want to talk to the people they don't want to talk to. They certainly don't want to be
Right.
nice to the people they don't want to be nice to.
That is.
I mean, if you decide I want to work collaboratively and in a friendly, empathic, human way with, anti-vax Trump supporters, if you decide you want to do that, even though you're a pro-vax Trump hater, you can do it. You can do it. The tough part is deciding you want to.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. We have just a few more minutes, and so I thought we would take just a moment to ask you if you had some sort of like last minute, last nuggets to give to us, advice to share before we have to unfortunately say goodbye.
Well, I don't know. I guess the last thing, the thing I just said is perhaps the thing that I want to leave people with, that this is mostly about wanting to do it. And I don't mean to say that it's not difficult. I mean, all of the things we're talking about, telling the truth is difficult. Acknowledging that you didn't tell the truth before is even more difficult. Acknowledging uncertainty, proclaiming uncertainty, explaining uncertainty, sounding like uncertainty doesn't mean you don't know anything, selling a recommendation uncertainly rather than not selling it at all. All of those are difficult things to do, but that I don't think the difficulty is the problem. I think the problem is that most of public health has decided not to do it. Most of public health, has decided, something much simpler. We're going to figure out what we want people to do. Then we're going to figure out what messages are likeliest to get them to do it. And then we are going to sell those messages hard. And And the people who don't want to be sold, we'll kind of ignore. And you know, I mean, I hate to say it. I think there are lots of people in public health whose not even quite secret attitude toward folks who don't choose to get vaccinated against COVID is okay, let them die. You know, the hell with them. If they still don't understand that COVID is dangerous and that they should get vaccinated, you know, screw them. You know, then you're not gonna try to figure out how to talk to them in ways they can hear. If you decide to try, I'm hoping I'm providing some guidance. And obviously, you know, the 52 of you who are still on this call have decided to try. I mean, there's huge optimism, or I'm feeling huge optimism about the fact that, you know, about 200 people started out, and about 50 of them are still left. So you know. You care, and the, you know, and you know, I mean, the messages I'm giving you are at least as hard for you to hear as the messages you want to give to anti-vaxxers are for them to hear. So if you can hear me, and you know, you're still here, if you can hear me, then you have a shot at them hearing you. And you know, my hope is that I've provided some sort of concrete skills to do that.
Well, I know that I have gained quite a bit from this talk, and you know, I'm thinking about how do I incorporate some of these ideas into the work that I do. So I really appreciate your time, taking the time to chat with us, coming out of, you know, I know that you're retired, so having these conversations, thank you very much. So appreciated, and I can see other folks thanking you in the chat. So with that, I think that I will stop the recording. And